Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Yud Amid Aleph, two lines down. The Gemara here is continuing to dash in the Psukim with regards to Shimshon. The Shimshon, it says, Vaygdalanar, Vayavarchehu Hashem. He got older. The youth, the young man became older. And Hashem gave him bracha. Bameh baracho. What was the bracha that he got? Rashi over here notes that the word bracha in general means kol bracha shebimikra lashon ribuihu. It's expansion or excess or a lot of something. Davar hamirabe umatsui bosova. Something that expands and people get satisfaction out of it. And he says, by Shimshon, we don't find that he has any of those brachot. We don't find that he has wealth. We don't find that he has children. We don't find any of those things that we would normally associate bracha, ribui with. And things that people enjoy and get satisfaction from. So the Gemara is now searching for what exactly was the bracha that Shimshon had. You could answer, and probably the Pashtut HaPasuk is, that he had the Ruach Hashem, and that he had the strength that was given to him. So here the Gemara says, Amar Yehuda Marav, Shebaracho Be'amato. He got the bracha through his Aver, his member, Amato Kivnei Adam, Vizaro Kenachol Shotef. So his Amma was like that of a grown man, and his zaro, his semen, was kenachal shotef, was like a flowing river. So he had a bracha in the area of his manhood, and we're going to see that that impacts later on, meaning both he sins in that sense, because he gets entrapped or ensnared by the plishti women, and later on we're going to see that part of his punishment involved this as well. It says, Vayikra Shimshon El Hashem. The end of his life, Shimshon calls out to Hashem, Vayom Hashem Elukim, Zachreini Na, V'chazkeni Na. Remember me, strengthen me, Achapam Azeh, this one more time, Nakmat, Nakamachat, Mishtei Einayim Miplishtim. And let me take revenge, one revenge, for my two eyes. So here Rashi notes over here that he's taking one revenge for two eyes. He says, Sacharachat meinai, tenli b'nei kamazo, that the reward for one of my eyes being poked out should be the revenge that I take now. Sacharacheret, the ulam haba. And the other one, I'll take the ulam haba. Or, I would say it in other words, we saw in yesterday's daf that Shimshon followed after his eyes, and therefore he was punished with his eyes being poked out. So one eye was the retribution, the kapara for that which he had done with his eyes. And now Shimshon is taking a claim on the other eye and saying, I want to take my final nekama on the plishtim and take down the temple where they were. Amar Rav, Amar Shimshon lifnei Kodesh Baruch Hu, Ribono Shel Olam zchor li esrim. The Gemara has a girsa of esrim v'shtayim shana, which is very difficult, because in the Navi and Shoftim, it says esrim shana, that he ruled over Bnei Yisrael, he shofet over Bnei Yisrael for 20 years. The girsa that we have here is esrim u'shtayim. So, obviously, you can see here that many of the Rishonim, Achronim, take out the word Shtayim because it doesn't seem like it belongs. Others suggest that the extra 2 years are associated with his time in prison. That he was Shofet Al Yisrael for 20 years, and then he was incarcerated for 2 years. And during those 2 years, Sukkim say that he worked the mills. So, as if he paid the taxation of the taxes for Bnei Yisrael, and therefore, he also benefited Bnei Yisrael during that time. That's what the Yisrim Ushtayim Shana is. It says, Zuchor li Yisrim Shana, Sheshafatati et Yisrael. Remember the 20 years I was acting as a shofet to Bnei Yisrael. V'lo marti l'achad mehem, Haver li makel mimakom l'makom. And I never asked anybody to do anything for me. It says, Ke'ein, what we see by Moshe Rabbeinu and by Shmuel, whereas true leaders, they don't use their position of leadership to take personal benefit from that. They're completely dedicated to the Kahal. Oh, and that's, Shimshon says the same thing over here, that I never took anything. I never asked anything for the fact that I was a shofet. I simply acted as a shofet. It was an altruistic thing that I did, and I took care of the people. And so I want to take my reward now for that. Vayelech Shimshon, Vayelekeid Shlosh Meod Shualim. So Shimshon, after his first altercation with the plishtim, he had married a plishti woman, and then after the sheva brachot, he had gone back home for a little bit, he comes back, and his father-in-law gave away the woman to another man. And so Shimshon gets all upset about that. He offers him his other daughter. And because of that, Shimshon decides to take revenge, quote unquote, on the Plishtim, because during his Sheva Brachot, we'll call it, given a riddle to the Plishtim, they had pressured his wife to give him the answer to the riddle. And then Shimshon has to then, he loses the bet because they have the riddle and he has to provide them with 30 suits. So he goes out and kills 30 Plishti men in order to provide the suits. And that leads to this tit-for-tat where by the Plishtim also end up killing his father-in-law and his quote-unquote wife. They burn them. And so there's this back and forth. Shimshon here takes these 300 foxes, ties their tails together, and puts torches in their tails. So now, in that incident, the question is, why did he use foxes to do this? Now, the foxes go around running around, and they end up burning up all the fields of the Plishtim. Amar Rabbi Aibo bar Nagde, Amar Rabbi Chir bar Abba, Amar Shimshon, Yavo mi shechuzer la'achurav, Vipara mi Plishtim shechazru b'shuatan. Said that the fox, or the nature of the fox, is when he is trapped or in a difficult position, he backs away, or he doesn't run away, but he slowly moves back or backwards. So through this, Shimshon was hinting at the Plishtim that they had chazru b'shvuatan, that they had backed out of their commitment, their oath. Now this might reference to what we said at the end of yesterday's daf, Amar Rabbi Chama, Rabbi Chanina, huchau shvuato shel Avimelech, that they had abrogated the covenant between Avimelech and Abraham. And so that's what Shimshon is suggesting over here, is that they backed out of the Shavuah, or he's talking about the nature or the way that he was treated with regards to his wife, that all of a sudden his father-in-law thought that Shimshon was very upset about the riddle and all that had happened, and he says, I thought you weren't coming back, so I gave her to another man. But again here, backing out of a commitment that this was his wife, so Shimshon uses the Shualim as a Mashal, to show them that that's what he was upset about. Tanya, Amar Rabbi Shimon HaChassid, Ben Ktefav Shel Shimon, Shishim Amahaya. Shimshon's shoulder span was 60 amot. It was a wide load. Shenemar, Vayishkav Shimshon Ad Chatzi Alayla. Shimshon goes to sleep until the middle of the night. Vayakam B'Chatzi Alayla, in the middle of the night he gets up. Vayochaz B'Daltot Sh'ar Ha'ir. Ubishtam Mizuzot goes ahead and he grabs the gates of the city as well as the frame of the gates of the city. He pulls them out of the ground with the locking mechanism, with everything. He takes them out. And he puts them on his shoulders and he carries them up to the mountain. Ugmiri, Dein Daltot Aza, Chutot Mishishim Ama. And we have a Misora that the gates to Aza were 60 amot wide. And if he put them up on his shoulders and carried them, then obviously his shoulder span is 60 amot. V'hi tochein v'beit asurim. So it says after they poked out his eyes, they put him into chains, into irons, and then they put him to work. So in that day, the milling was done either by people or by animals. The milling used to have to walk around the millstone to turn or grind the mill. So they made use of Shimshon when they had incarcerated him. They made him work the mill and use that quote-unquote strength that he had in order to turn the mill. Amar Rabbi Yochanan in Tchina Eloshon Aveira. Rabbi Yochanan says he can't take it kipashuto, but rather the Tchina here is Eloshon Aveira. V'cheinu Umer. And we have evidence of the fact that the word Tochein is used in the context of Aveira, because it says, by Yov, Titchan Lacher Ishti, that my wife will mill for someone else. That's a euphemism. Not the literally that she'll mill for someone else, but milling or that type of work is what the woman does in the household. And that's what a woman does for her husband and for her household. And so the euphemism is that Tidchana Cherishti is that another man will sleep with my wife. So the same thing over here, Rabbi Yochanan is suggesting that the Tochein over here by the Beit HaSurim is Shimshon is sleeping with women. Malameid. That everyone would bring their wife to the jail in order to have children through Shimshon. They wanted to have children like Shimshon with his strength and with all of his attributes. So what they do is they bring their wives there in order to have them become pregnant from Shimshon and have children like Shimshon. So whether to take that literally, and that's what they did, or to say akin to what Rabbi Yochanan says in the Gemara, that he used to sit outside the mikveh, because when the women exited the mikveh, they would see his beauty. And in seeing his beauty, that would impact on the children that they had. The Gemara notes in many places, and we've discussed it in the past, that what a person sees or has in mind at the time of Biyah, according to Chazal, has a big impact on the Ubar that is created. And so therefore, whatever the person is looking at that time will have impact on the type of child that you have. And so maybe over here, they don't take it literally, but rather that they came to look at Shimshon. So that would be the picture or the image that they had in mind when they had Biyah. So that would produce a child similar to Shimshon. The question of why they don't take the Pasuk literally. Why is Rabbi Yochanan looking to take the Pasuk not literally, but through some sort of drasha? The Achronim over here try to explain why Shimshon was not ra'oi. He was not capable of milling, and therefore it had to mean something else. And we'll see here one example in the Gemara that Shimshon was not possibly capable of running the mill. So therefore you have to give an alternate explanation of it. Amar Papa, Hanu Damre Inche, Kame Deshate Chamra Chamra, Kame Refuka Gridaya Dovla. So before those that drink wine, Chamra, you bring them wine. People who enjoy good wine, people who are wine connoisseurs, you bring them wine because that's what they enjoy. Kame Refuka, Refuka is to loosen the ground, to hold the ground. So here it's talking about someone who works the gardens. Then you bring before them, Gridaya Dovla, you bring before them baskets of vegetables. So you bring before people that which they're accustomed to, that which they enjoy. That's the pidgam, the common saying. And what is the reference to over here is that Shimshon, who enjoyed plishti women, and he was chasing after plishti women during his lifetime, both in his first wife in Timnotah, then later on with the Zonah, and then afterwards with Delilah. So that's what he wanted. That's what he enjoyed. So that's what they, in the end, quote-unquote, fed him. That he had more plishti women even after he was incarcerated. V'amar Rabbi Yochanan, kol mezaneh ishto mezanenet alav. A person who acts in a promiscuous manner has extramarital affairs, then his wife will use that as a model or mimic that behavior, and she will also act in this manner. Shenamar, so the same pasuk that we quoted from Iyov before, just the pasuk before, which is, Im niftali bi alisha, if my heart is seduced by a woman, val petach rei aravti, and now I am caught or ensnared by the doorway of my friend, meaning that he is now having an affair with another woman, uchtiv, and then the subsequent pasuk, which we quoted from Yo before, is titchan lacher ishti, then my wife will be to someone else. So here there is this midah keneged midah, quid pro quo, which is that if you act in this way, then you can expect your wife to act in this way. Baleha yichru'un acherim. And others will bend over her, meaning that others will have biyah with her. V'ayinu damre inshe. And here is again the common saying that people say, iu beik are, v'itite beibotzine. That he is with the gourd, and his wife is with the gourd. So Rashi over here says that the ke'are and the botzini minachadu, they're one species. Elish elu gdolim ve'elu ktanim. One is big and one is small. Or basically, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. That expression that if you're acting in this way, you're going to expect the same type of behavior from the other individual. You can see here that he references you to the Oruch, who takes it much more literally. And it says that there's some sort of deviant behavior that's done with these vegetables, but that's the Aruch's explanation. Rashi and Tosafot also discuss in other places in Shas what is the relationship between Kare Ubotzine, whether they really are one species of different size, or they actually are two different species, two different types of gourds, or one's a zucchini, one's a gourd. But either way, the expression means similar behavior, or behavior that is expressed by one will be expressed by the other. And again, this could be here to explain why a husband who doesn't take care of his wife and doesn't treat his wife properly can expect that his wife will then either seek that husbandry somewhere else, or don't imagine just because you're behaving this way, you think that no one's aware of it or nobody, but people sense the way that you're behaving or sense that what you're doing, and then they will emulate that behavior. So if you want your wife to be monogamous with you, then you have to act that way towards her. Now, obviously, this isn't a ironclad rule that any time the husband is not good, then the wife's not good. If the wife's not good, it's a result of the husband not being good, because otherwise, we'd never have a parsha of sota. Because there it says, v'nika ish me'avom, that the man has to have a clean slate. If you're saying here that one is the result of the other, then how will the husband ever be v'nika ish me'avom? And so therefore, you have to suggest here that obviously, this is not an ironclad rule, but it is an expectation that one can have that you shouldn't just assume that you can do as you please, and then all the other people will have fidelity towards you and allow you to just act in this manner. But if you're acting in a manner that lacks fidelity, then you can expect that the parties that interact with you will have that same approach. Now the Gemara says, "Am Rabbi Yochanan, Shimshon danet Israel kaviyim shebashamayim." Shimshon judged, adjudicated Bnei Yisrael like a Kodesh Baruch Hu. Shneamar Dan Yadin Amo Keachad. So here, Dan Yadin Amo, he would rule over, judge over the people. Now here, the pasuk literally says Keachad Shiftei Yisrael, but instead of using Keachad Shiftei Yisrael, they parse the pasuk at Keachad, and Keachad means like the one. The one is a Kodesh Baruch Hu. Rashi says Ki Chido Shel Olam B'Mishpat Tzedek. Rashi says that he adjudicated like Hashem does, which is, he was honest, just, and correct in his judgments. So Rashi sees this as equating the type of justice that he met out, or the type of justice that he adjudicated, was like a Kodesh Baruch Hu, which was, he was very good at it, and he did an excellent job at it. Others suggest that Keachad means he forewent all the procedural things that normally come to a Beit Din, and he judged like Hashem, similar to the Mishnah in Avot, which says that a person can't be Dan Yechidi, because ain't Dan Yechidi, Ella HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Hashem is the only one who judges alone. Yet, here, Shimshon judges alone, so he's Keachad, he's like Hashem. And also, if he judges without Edim, Hatra'ah, or maybe more so, he had Ruach Hashem. And the Ruach Hashem is what helps him to judge, and therefore he's going to judge like Hashem would in these situations, because he is enveloped by the Ruach Hashem. Rabbi Yochanan, Shimshon al Shmo shel Kodesh Baruch Hu Nikra. Shimshon's name derives from the name of Hashem. Shneamar, Kishemesh umagein Hashem Elokim. Hashem is like the sun and a shield. Now here the Gemara is taking Kishemesh not to mean the sun, but Rashi over here says the word Shemesh over here means like a wall. Lashon Chumah. He quotes a pasuk from Yeshayahu, uses the word, or the shorish of Shemesh, not to mean the sun, but rather to mean a wall. And then for the Magain, the protection here is like the wall that provides that protection. So now the Gemara says that's the name of Hashem. And Shimshon is a derivative of that name of Hashem, of Shemesh. So Gemara says, Elam Yatov, that's true, lo yimacheh. Then you shouldn't erase the name. Elam Ein Shmo Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It is like the name of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Ma HaKadosh Baruch Hu Magin Al Kol HaOlam Kulo. Just like Hashem protects the whole world, it takes care of the whole world. Av Shimshon Magin B'Doro Al Yisrael. So to Shimshon and his generation protected Klal Yisrael. So here it's interesting, the two stages of the Gemara which Tosafot takes up. He says, even if the word Shemesh meant the Shem Hashem, why would you even have a Havamina that you couldn't erase it? The words Rachum, Chanun, when they're used to refer to Hashem, nobody says you can't erase those names. It says here, Tosafot notes the distinction that the Gemara makes in Shavuot, which is that there are certain names of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which are names of Hashem, but are not subject to the restriction of erasure, whereas there are other names of Hashem which are subject to the erasure. One of the examples he brings is the word Shalom. The Gemara in the beginning of Shabbat says that one cannot give shalom to chavero bebeit amerchatz or before tefillah, because shalom is the shem ha-shem. And so you can't utilize that way. But nobody suggests that you can't erase the word shalom. because it's a name of Hashem. And so the distinction the Gemara draws is to between names that are be'etzem, meaning names that are inherent or the real names of Hashem, versus names that are descriptive of the way that Hashem interacts with the world, or characteristics or character traits of a Kodesh Baruch Hu. So Rachum, Chanun, Shalom, all those may be Shemot of Hashem, but they're not Shemot She'inam Nimchakim, because they aren't what we call Shemot Be'etzin. They're not real names of Hashem. They're names that give description to the way that Hashem acts or the interactions or character traits that he has. And so what he says the stages of the Gemara here are, at first it said Shemesh, assuming that that was a real name of Hashem. That it's not describing something. What does the Shemesh describe? In the end, the Gemara says, no. It's not a Shem Be'etzem, but rather it's a Shem of description. And that's what the Gemara does in the end. The Gemara says, just like Hashem is Megin al Olam, the word Shemesh, so too Shimshon was Megin al Klal Yisrael. So you see in the end, that's what the Gemara is doing. It's darshening the word to, as a description of Hashem's interaction with the world, not as a name of Hashem. And the Ibn Ezra and the Ramban and Parshat Shmot talk about that a lot, about Yudke Vavke being the real or actual name of a Kodesh Baruch Hu, and therefore it's very different than other names that are used to describe Hashem that always involve some sort of description, whether it's his power, whether it's his character traits. Even the word Elohim that is used, or Adon, describe Hashem's power, Hashem's rulership, Hashem's ownership. All of these things are not necessarily Shem Be'etzem. So you have to know there are different levels of names of a Kodesh Baruch Hu. Some names, again, like Yud Kei Vav Kei, which is actually the name of Hashem, whereas Shem Elohim, which is also has a certain amount of Kedusha describing Hashem, but also a name that's given to God that cannot be erased. And then there's a third type, which is clearly only about describing the character trait of a Kodesh Baruch Hu. Now the Gemara says, V'am Rabbi Yochanan, Bilam chiger b'raglo achataya. Bilam was lame in one leg. Shenemar, Vayelech Shefi. That he went Shefi. Here the Gemara is interpreting the word Shefi not to mean to that, to a place, but rather Shefi, which is, means to dislocate. And therefore, Vayelech Shefi means that he was walking with a dislocated leg. One of his legs didn't work, possibly a result of his traveling on the donkey and getting crushed against the wall when he was riding on the donkey. Shimshon chiger b'shtei raglav haya. Shimshon was lame in both legs. Shenemar shvifon aleorach. Like the serpent of the path. So shvifon is a serpent, but here the Gemara is playing on the double pay there. So it's like a double shefi, a plural of shefi, shvifon, which means that he was dislocated in both legs. You could interpret it literally, which is shvifon is like a serpent that slithers on the ground, that Shimshon couldn't walk because of the dislocation of his legs, so he had, that's how he got around, that's how he had to move. Now this brings up the question, based on this drusha of Rabbi Yochanan, that brings back to Rabbi Yochanan's member before, Am Rabbi Yochanan tchina lashon avera. Why did he have to reinterpret tchina to mean avera? Because over here you see that Shimshon wouldn't have been capable of turning the mill around because he couldn't walk. So then what do you do with the word tchina? So you have to reinterpret the word tchina to be a euphemism rather than literally. Tarim banan, chamisha nivru mein dugma shel mala, v'kulan lakuben. There are five people that have traits that are resembling a Kodesh Baruch Hu. Obviously, you can't take that literally because Kodesh Baruch Hu doesn't have anything like this, and therefore it won't be relevant. So as Rashi over here notes, mein dugma shnishtanu min atachtonim l'tiferet. They had something that was unique or unusual about them, that made them stand out, but stand out in a positive way. So they have these unusual character traits or unusual physical traits that made them unique or noticeable. And that's what it means, main dugma shel malo. They are like something that's so unique and special, it's as if godly in nature. Or you could argue this, kein dugma shel malo is that when a Kodesh Baruch Hu created Adam HaRishon, Adam HaRishon had all and everything. He was the perfect creation. So main dugma shel malo is these individuals had this component of them was kein dugma malo, was like way a Kodesh Baruch Hu created Adam. And so they have these unique areas. And every one of them was punished in the end. The obvious idea here being midah, keneged midah. Hashem endowed them with this unique or special character trait, and now if they don't use it or they abuse it, then HaKadosh Baruch Hu takes retribution from them, from that unique character trait or that item itself. The individuals are Shimshon b'kocho, tremendous strength of Shimshon, Sha'ol b'tzavaro, Sha'ol with his neck, is based on the pasuk that says that Mishichmo l'malo, that he was, the expression head and shoulders above everybody else, that he stood taller than everyone else, meaning that he was a head above everyone else, that means his neck. Avshalom b'saro, Avshalom with his hair. Tzidkiyah b'enav, with his eyes, and asa b'raglav. So now the Gemara is going to go through each one of them. Shimshon b'kocho d'chtiv, v'aser kocho me'alav. So we know about Shimshon's tremendous strength, and how to know he's punished, is that when he wakes up after his hair is cut off, v'aser kocho me'alav, he no longer had that strength. So he's punished, and that strength being taken away, and that's how he's captured in the end. Sha'ol b'tzavaro, d'chtiv, how do we know that Sha'ol was punished by his neck? It says, v'yikach Sha'ol t'cherev, Sha'ol basically takes out the sword and falls on his sword so that he won't fall into the hands of the Plishtim. So when he falls onto the sword, how do you know that was the neck? Rashi says that generally when you're using a sword or cutting with the sword, it's done at the neck level. That's why the punishment of hereg is done with a sword or a knife across the neck. And similar to the way that the Gemara describes the Romans executed people, they used to take off their heads with a sword. So that the sword was associated with the neck. So if he fell on his sword, he must have fallen on his neck into the sword. Avshalom b'sa'aro, Avshalom by his hair, k'b'de'inan l'meimar l'kaman, which we're going to explain shortly. The Gemara is going to go into more agadah with regards to Avshalom. So we'll defer the explanation until then. Tzidkiyahu b'enav, Tzidkiyahu with his eyes, t'chtiv etenei Tzidkiyahu iver. He's talking about Nebuchadnezzar, after Tzidkiyahu rebels against Nebuchadnezzar, and then is running away towards the Midbar. So then when he's caught by Melech Bavel, as a punishment, Melech Bavel slaughters all of his children in front of him, and then pokes out his eyes. So that's what happened to Tzidkiyahu. Rashi claims over here that Tzidkiyahu had beautiful eyes, and therefore he was punished with those beautiful eyes being taken out. But as Rashi says, we have no source for that. We have no evidence of that. In all likelihood, the evidence is the fact that he was punished with his eyes implies that there must have been something special about his eyes. Asabi raglav, dichtiv rak leit ziknato chalat raglav. That only when he got older did he have trouble with his legs that he was unable to then be mobile. So again here, we have no source for the fact that he was unusual with his legs, but the fact that that was his punishment is indicative of the fact that that must have been what he had that was unusual. Although there is a pasuk in Divrei Yamim that suggests that Asa was able to run or ran along with the Kushi very fast. And so maybe that would be the source for this. Amar Rabbi Yehuda, Amar Rav, what happened to his legs when he got older? Shachsato Padagra. That he got this sickness called Padagra. Amalei Marzutra Breda Rav Nachman, Rav Nachman, Hechidami Padagra. What is this disease called Padagra? Or how does it feel? Amalei Kemachat Babasarcha. It's like putting a needle into live skin. And you're poking yourself with a needle, which is extremely painful. Mena Yodo, how does he know? Ikadami Mecha Shavi Chashve. Some say that Rav Nachman suffered from this Padagra. Ikadami Mirabe Shmile. Others say that he had a Mesorah, that this was the type of pain. That the secrets of Hashem are given over to those that fear him. And it's his covenant to make them aware. So that Hashem provides those that are close to him, or those that are Tamidei Chachamim, steeped in Torah, so they get these secrets from Hashem, or they get this information, even though they technically shouldn't have it, or they're not experts in this area. Nevertheless, Hashem blesses them, endows them with this unusual understanding, this Padagra. It's translated loosely as gout, which is a disease that affects the joints, but especially the lower feet or the toes, and leaves them in extremely painful in that area. And that's what Rav Nachman is explaining over here, that it's like kemachat b'basar chai. It's like putting a needle into a live skin. Dorish Rabba, mipa ma'ane nash asa. Why was Asa punished? Okay, now you're saying it's a midah keneged midah, but what exactly did he do? So, mipnei shasan gariya b'tamidei chachamim. Because he taxed the tamidei chachamim, and gariya is a physical tax, which means you come to work for the king, that you're enslaved or forced to do labor for the king as a taxation, and we have descriptions of that by Shlomo Melech, that they had a rotating taxation where people used to have to come to the Melech for a month or 2 months at a time and work for him, and that was part of the taxation. So over here it says that Asa did that with Tamidei Chachamim, who should have been exempt from the tax. Shenemar, v'melech Asa ishmiat kol Yehuda. He gathers all of Yehuda together in order to help him take away the block that the king of Israel was trying to put there. The king of Israel was building area to basically block off access to the Melech Yehuda, to the trade routes or to other nations. And so he does that by building in the lower Shomron, in the Ramah. And Asa comes at a time when he has the ability, when the Melech Yisrael is busy fighting a battle somewhere else, he brings all the people of Yehuda to clear that area out to stop the building that was done over there. So now, Einaki, when he says it's Shmiel Kol Yehuda, it says Einaki. Nobody was let free or exempted. My Einaki, what does it mean no one was exempt? Amar Yehuda Marav, afilu chatan mechedro v'kala mechupata. Even newly married individuals who normally would be exempt from any of this, they were brought out. Gemara here is playing on the Lashon of Mechemet Mitzvah, which is by Mechemet Mitzvah, we say that afilu chatan mechedro and kala mechupata, they go out to help in Mechemet Mitzvah. So over here, the Gemara is playing on that. This might have wasn't a milchama, but it might have been something akin to it, which is that it was something that was very serious. And of course, if he took a chatan and kala right after their wedding, then choshkein tamidei chachamim, that he put them to work, and that was an improper usage of the tamidei chachamim, or caused bittul Torah, whatever you want to describe it as here, but he's then taken to task for doing that. All right, now the Gemara goes back. Titiv, vayered Shimshon tanmat timnata. Shimshon went down to Timnah. Uchtiv, hinei chamich ola timnata. By Tamar and Yehuda, the information is told to Tamar that her father-in-law is going to be going up to Timnata. So the obvious problem with the Psukim is that by Shimshon he descends to Timnata, and here by Yehuda he's ascending to Timnata. So which one is it? Is the Timnata in a high place, or is Timnata in a low place? So Amar Rabbi Lazar, Shimshon shinitgana ba tibbe yirida. So that is not literal, but rather figurative. Shimshon, who the incidents that take place there are not favorable, therefore he's vayered. He went down. On the other hand, Yehuda shinitaleba. On the other hand, Yehuda, who is made kadosh, or has an exemplary behavior that comes out of this, where he admits that Tamar was right, tzadka mimeni. So there it says that vayale, that he's going a lot, that he's going up, because in the end, that's what results in his having an aliyah. Therefore, k'tiv be aliyah. Rav Shmuel bar Nachmani amar shtei timnaot ayu. Chad b'yirida v'chad b'aliyah. Simple answer to the question, which is that the word timna is not only one place. There's two different timnas, timna aleph, timna bet, whatever you want to call it, and one you have to descend to, and one you ascend to. Or Rav Papa Amar, the answer that you wanted to give, chad timna havai. There was one timna, da'ati mehai gisa yirida. If you come from one side, then you descend to it. Da'ati mehai gisa aliyah. If you come from the other side, then you will ascend to get to the city. Kigon. And now they give examples of Vardanya, Ubei Bari, Vishuka Dinash. These locations have a similar feature, which is depends where you enter from. One side you enter from, you're descending towards it. The other side that you enter from, you are ascending to these locations. And so they give you examples of places that have this feature or phenomenon. Vateshev v'petach einayim says there that Tamar sit at the crossroads. So Amar of Alexandri Malameit shalchav yashva la b'pitcho shal Avram Avinu. She went to the place where Avram Avinu used to set up tent, because Avram Avinu was looking for all the passerbys, all the people that he wanted to bring in as guests. Makom shkol einayim tzofot liroto. Place where everybody looked, or everybody looks to see what's going on. So it's a public thoroughfare, scenario with heavy traffic. So that's why it's associated with Abraham, who liked the heavy traffic because of the Hnasat Orchim, which Rashi translates over here, everybody looked forward to the bed and breakfast of Abraham. So that was something that they looked forward to. That was something that they were excited about. Or in a more pashut sense, Sofot Deroto is that it's a place where it's a milestone or a landmark that everybody knows about and everybody looks forward to seeing it. Bichanan Amar, Rabbi Chanan Amar Rabbi Makom Hu Sheshmo Einayim. There's literally a place called Einayim. Bichenu Omer, it says in Yoshua with regards to the cities that they conquer and inherit, it says Tapuach Vainam. Or play there, Einayim would be the plural of this Einam, but there is a place that has a similar name to it, and that's what it's referencing here, the real name of the city. She gave herself a heter. She was matir for herself this behavior, or justified this behavior, and that's what it means, Einayim. She took a look at it, or she gave an eye to it that, okay, this is acceptable. And she acts in a way that's not so acceptable, but because of the circumstances, it was the only way that she could get justice done in this case. So when Yehuda comes and solicits requests to sleep with her, Amarla, there was conversation was a little longer. Shemen achritat, maybe you are a non-Jew. Amarla, gioretani, I'm a convert. Shema ishit ish at, maybe you're a married woman. Amarla, pnuyani, I'm a single woman. Shema kibel bach avich kiddushin, maybe your father accepted kiddushin on your behalf. Amarla, yitomani, can't be because I am a orphan. My father has no right to marry me off because he doesn't exist anymore. So who will marry me off? My mother, my brothers? That's only midrabanan that there's kiddushin. They don't really have a right to marry me off. What she's referencing over here, that she was married to Erev Onan, she really wasn't married midoraita, only me, to Rabbanan. Shema tmeat, maybe you are impure. Amle tohorani, that I am pure. So here, the tribute to Yehuda, rather than this being an act with a prostitute, over here now they make it into an act where Yehuda is querying about information about the woman, making sure that she is proper, appropriate for him to consort with. So there's a longer conversation that takes place. Rashi over here notes, what's very interesting is that if Tamar declares herself to be Toma over here, that would argue on the other Midrash that Tamar was the daughter of Shem. Because the only time that it's relevant that a father accepts Kiddushin on behalf of his daughter is when his daughter is a minor. That would mean that Tamar was young, under the age of 12. Shem dies when Yaakov is 60 years old. He is much older, and therefore you could not say that she was a Yitoma at this time, because she would have been 50 years old at least if she was the daughter of Shem. So Rashi says these are conflicting midrashim as to whether she's the daughter of Shem or whether she was Yitoma in this case. Vayita esho beber sheva, so just what we had in last week's parsha, that Abraham plants an esho in Beer Sheva. Amarish Lakish, Malameid, Shasa Pardes, Venatabo Komine Migadim. He made an orchard, and he planted all of these wonderful fruits inside of the orchard. Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Nechemiah, Chadamar Pardes, one of them says that it was an orchard. Chadamar Pundak, one of them says that it was a bed and breakfast, a motel of sorts. Bishlam Alamandamar Pardes, the one who says that it was an orchard. Hainu Dechtim Vaita. That's why he planted, because you went out in an orchard, you gotta plant trees in order to have an orchard. Alamandamar Pundak, the one who says that it was a bed and breakfast. Mai Vaita. What does it mean that he planted? Kidichtiv, vaita, ohale, apadno. So we see the word vaita is used in the context of an ohel, which is to pitch a tent. The pitching of a tent, the verb that is used for pitching a tent, as well as planting a tree, is vaita. And therefore what it means, vaita over here, doesn't necessarily mean that he planted the tree, but rather he planted his tent. Right, he put the stakes in, he pitched his tent over there. Evidence to that from the pasuk in Daniel, Vayita olei apadno, the king pitched all of his royal tents. Vayikra sham b'shem Hashem kelulam. After Vayita isho, then it says there that he called out in the name of Hashem. Amresh Lakish, al tikra vayikra. Don't say that he called out, but rather, ele vayakri, that he caused others to call out. Malameich, yikri Avraham Avinu l'shmo shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu b'peh kol over b'shav. That he used to cause Hashem's name to be on the lips of all those that were passing by. Ketzad. Well, how would he do that? How would he encourage them to recognize God and to understand that there is a God and give thanks to him? Achar shachlu v'shatu. After they ate and drank, amdu levarachon. They got up to give him a bracha, which means both to thank him, and in their day, part of thanking the person is that you give them a bracha. Amalehem, michisheli achaltem? You ate my stuff? This wasn't my stuff. Michel elukei olam achaltem. You ate from God's stuff. Hodo vishabchu baruchu lemisha marvaya olam. You should give praise or thanks to a Kodesh Baruch Hu for that which he provided you. Well, what happens if they refused at that point? Who says they're going to agree to do this? Who says they're not going to refuse? So the Tosfot Shatz over here says that Avraham Avinu had a little lever that made sure that everybody agreed to do this. That is, he suggests over here, Yesh b'midrash lo ratzu levarech b'tzonam, people didn't voluntarily give a bracha to Hashem, ad shamar lehem Avraham, peru mashachaltem v'shititem, pay for what you ate and drank. Listen, this is the cost of the meal that you had. It's on the house if you give a bracha to Hashem. You don't give a bracha to Hashem, you're going to have to pay for it. And he used to say to them that the meal you ate is extremely expensive. They were in the middle of a desert. And it was hard work to bring and make sure that there was food in that location. When they saw that they might have to pay for the meal that they just eat, Az Baruch Hu Kodesh Baruch Hu Shelo Birtzanam Amad Shelo Yifru Shum Davar. So even against their will, he was able to compel them to give a bracha, because he gave them the choice between paying and giving a bracha to Hashem, and most of them opted to give the bracha to Hashem and instead of having to pay for the meal. So that would explain how Avram compelled individuals to recognize the Shem Hashem, Yikra B'Shem Hashem Kel Olam, and that would explain the nature of this Eshel. Or the Eshel was a tree that was the fruit supply for providing for these individuals? Or was the Eshel his tent that he used to welcome people in and take care of people? And Rashi over here quotes the famous Midrash about Lashon Eshel, no trikun. It's an acronym for Achila, Shtia, and Leviyah. Food, drink, and accompaniment. Leviyah could also be accompaniment, meaning that keeping them company. But more likely, via means that you accompany them a portion of the journey in order to that they leave in a safe and easy manner. Other version of the Midrash is Achila Shtia and Lina, and lodging. So here you have the description of what this Eshel is of Avraham Avinu. So Yehuda sees Tamar sitting in the fork of the road, and he thinks that she's a Zona because she's covering her face. Tamar says that's backwards. Mishum de kasta panach shvad zona, because she's covering her face, a practice that is tsanua, and obviously is not done by people who are prostitutes, because they want people to see them. They want people to be attracted to them. And therefore they wouldn't be mechaseh panim. So it makes no sense. Why did he think she was a zona if she covered her face? Malazar she kista panach bebeit chamia, because she covered her face when she was in her father-in-law's house. Damar of Shmuel Bar Nachmani and Rabbi Yonatan Kol Kala Shitznuah BeBeit Avia. Any kala who is modest in her father-in-law's house, Zochav Yotzi Mimena Melachim Nuvim, then they are meriting that their offspring will be kings and prophets. Minalan, how do we know this? Mitamar, we know this from Tamar. Nevi'im Dichtiv Chazon Ishayahu Ben Amotz, because Ishayahu's father was named Amotz, and we have a Masorah. The Gemara Megillah talks about this, that whenever you have a Navi and his father's name is mentioned, that means that his father was a Navi as well. So Chazon Yishayahu ben Amotz means Amotz was also a Navi. And Milachim mi David, and kings from David. It's obvious that Tamar and Yehuda are the progenitors of Machot Beit David and the Melech HaMashiach. But the fact that this Navi, Yishayahu ben Amotz, descended from her, that's not clear at all. But we have the Amar Rabbi Levi, Davar Zer Mesorah B'Yadenu Mavoteinu, we have a Mesorah that Amotz V'Amatzia Achim Havu. Amotz and Amatzia were brothers. Amatzia is one of the Malchei Yehuda. So Amatzia is one of the Malchei Yehuda, is clearly a descendant of Tamar. But if his brother is Amotz, that means that Amotz is also a descendant of Tamar, and therefore Ashayahu ben Amotz is a descendant of Tamar, and there you have now an example of a Navi that came out of her. Over here, Rashi says, "Yekistapanev beit chamia," that she covered her face in her father-in-law's house. V'lo ra'alta kol yamim she gadla bibito v'kach liyukirba. He never really got a glimpse of her. He never knew who she was. He never saw her while she was in her father-in-law's house. And therefore now when he meets her, he doesn't have any recognition or any semblance. She doesn't trigger in his mind any recognition because he never really saw her. That's what makes Kiki stop by now when she was married to his children. Therefore now when he meets her, he doesn't recognize her. On the other hand, the Tosfot Shas brings an alternative version of this, which is, even though in his heart he realized that this woman looks very familiar and that I must have seen her before I know her, but he made a mistake thinking, yeah, no, it's got to be someone else. Because Tamar was so tznua, either you could say it couldn't be her, or her tzniut made it that it wasn't easy for Yehuda to recognize her. So even though he had an inkling that it was her, he still couldn't be certain because she was so tznua, he didn't have a really good sense of who she was or what she looked like. And that's what it means, lo yikira, over here. He didn't recognize her because even though he knew her and he should have recognized her, maybe even did subconsciously recognize her, nevertheless, lo yikira, at this moment, he didn't recognize her. Versus the other version that Rashi brought down, which is lo yikira, is literally, he did not recognize her at all, period. He had no inkling or she had no semblance of someone that he knew. He mutzeit, the Gemara says the Torah describes Tamar being taken out to be burnt at the stake. It says there, he mutzeit. Gemara says, that's not the proper verb. It should say, he mitotzet mi ba'ilei. So because he mutzeit, as Rashi notes over here, means that she was found. Mutzeit means that, like when you find an aveda, it's mutzeit. You now have it. You've now made it available. It's now here. So the he mutzeit makes it as if they found her there all of a sudden. He mutetzet means she was taken out. That she was actively taken out, which should have been the proper verb here. Amar Rabbi Loza, the achashe nimtzu simanea, after she found the simanim, basamael verichakam, bagavriel vikirvam. So you're right. It's not talking about Tamar over here. When we're talking about he mutzeit, it's not talking about her. It's talking about the evidence that she had at the trial. So she put together the evidence for sending to Yehuda. And then Samael, who is the prince, the Tsar of Edom, came along and split them apart so that David HaMelech, or the Shoshela David HaMelech, would not be born, who is the archenemy or the nemesis of Edom. So he pulled the simanim apart. Ba Gabriel v'kirvan. Gabriel, who is the Malach of Eish and protects Bnei Yisrael in many instances, he brought them back together because this was going to be her salvation. So that's what it means over here. He mutzeit, it was found. It's found means the simanim were found because the malachim were fighting over what was going to be with these simanim. Haynu dichtiv, that's what it's meant in the pasuk in Tehilim and Matzeach. Al yonat elim, rochukim l'David michtam. As Rashi says, that explains the way to translate this pasuk is, Yunit Eileim Rechokim, Aliske Har Chaka, Shinasu Simane Rechokim, the David Michtam, the Oto Shaita Ruyav Omedet, let's say Mimena David. For that one that was Michtam over here means like imprinted or an outgrowth of this situation. So that's what it means, the David Michtam, that it was sealed or destined that David would come out of her. Why? Because Eileim Rechokim. Because of the issue of those things that were distanced. What are those things that were distanced? Were the simanim. And then Gabriel came and put them back together. So David says that my future was determined by this question of things that were moved closer or further away from each other. Once the simanim were taken away by Samael, she was like a silenced bird or silenced dove because she had no more claims. She had nothing to show anymore. Without that evidence, she couldn't do anything. The David michtav, she yatzah mimena David, she yamach v'tam lakol. Because of her behavior here, she was zocha. The David HaMelech descended from her, who was mach, means poor, v'tam means simple or whole. So over here it says, they're introducing the word michtam, a contraction of mach and tam. And Rashi says over here that mach is anav me'od. Machmin poor means that he acted like someone who was a regular lay person, and he was an anav. Vitam is tamim bidrachav, that he was wholesome in his ways. Devar acher, michtam, shaitam, makato, tama. that his injury was healed, meaning that he did not have to get a brit milah because he was born mahul. And therefore his makato, the place where they normally would have to do, quote unquote, some damage in order to have the person have a brit milah, he didn't have the extra nolad shu mahul because he was born with a brit milah already. Devar acher michtam kshem shebekatnuto iktin atzmo etzel mishu gadol mimenu lumod Torah. Just like in his youth, he used to belittle himself to sit in front of others to learn Torah. Kach begadluto. So too, when he got older, he continued to be an anav, a person of humility to sit and learn Torah from anybody who was wiser and knew more than him. Tamar sends the evidence over to Yehuda and says, whoever these belong to, that's who I am pregnant from. Why doesn't she just say it to him straight? Why is she beating around the bush, sending these simanim over to him? Why doesn't she say, I'm pregnant from you? So I'm Rav Zutra, Bar Tuvia, I'm Rav. Vamrila, Rav Hanana, Bar Bizna, I'm Rabbi Shimon, Chasida. Vamrila, I'm Rabbi Yochanan, Mishim, Rabbi Shimon, Bar Yochai. Noach lo adam shi apila etzmo l'toch kivshan ha'esh. It's better for a person to throw themselves into the fire. Val yabin p'nei ha'chamiru b'rabim. So that he should not embarrass his fellow comrade in public. Minalan. How do we know this? Mitamar. From Tamar. Because over here, she's being taken out to the stake. She's going to be burnt at the stake. And the only thing that will prevent that from happening is if she brings evidence to the contrary. So she has evidence over here, but she doesn't just speak up and say, I have evidence, or this is the case. She rather sends it to him for his own acknowledgement. And so from that you learn, because had she said it directly to him, he would have been embarrassed. So in order to avoid embarrassing Yehuda, she's willing to go to the stake and be burnt at the stake. Now Tosafot over here takes this Gemara very literally. It says that a person here has to give up their life rather than embarrass them in public. So Tosafot says, why isn't that mentioned by the three cardinal sins that we say, Yehareg Val Yavor? There's certain mitzvot that you have to do, even at the expense of your life. And those are Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayot, and Shfichut Damim. So over here, you have a fourth category, which is embarrassing someone in public. Better to give up your life than embarrass them in public. So Tosafot says, Einach Nami. It is true. The reason it doesn't mention him with the three cardinal sins is because those are written in the Torah. Whereas this is just a drasha out of the psukim in the Torah, not something that's more explicit. But then Tosafot says, Einoch Hanami, if you were faced with the choice of embarrassing someone in public or losing your life, that one would have to give up their life in this case. And therefore Tosafot takes it as being real literally, Yehareg v'al yavur, and that you would have to give up your life to protect someone else's dignity and protect against their humiliation and not embarrass them in public. And that's what we learn from Tamar over here, that she was willing to sacrifice her life in order not to embarrass Yehuda in public. It's also true, she needs Yehuda to make an admission to change what's been going on in the family and what's been a persistent problem since early times of the Avot about taking responsibility and admitting to the points where you are wrong. And Yehuda is really this point where he makes Sadkami Meni is really the turning point in Sefer Bereishit and the turning point in Yehuda's life as well. And it has a very positive impact on the fact that she got him to admit to it. So there was a value in having him admit rather than just simply hand him the items and say, it's you. Because then she wouldn't have gotten the moral lesson and the benefit of him admitting and taking responsibility, which was a big part of the tshuva that Yehuda needed to do. Nevertheless, Tosafot over here takes it literally and says it's Yehareg v'al yavur. The Rabbis Rishonim Acharim believe that this is just derech melitza, derech mashal, that it's so serious that one would have to consider giving up their life before embarrassing someone in public. So that's just to give you an indication of the severity of the crime, but not to tell you literally that one has to give up their life in order not to embarrass someone in public. All right, now the Gemara continues the story of Tamar and says, Hakir na. She says to them, recognize who these items belong to. Amar Rab Chama Rabbi Chanina, Hakir Biser Laviv. Yehuda broke the news to his father about Yosef through Hakir na. Hakir Bisruhu. Then in Bida Keneged Mida, he got the same thing. When he was told the awful news, or when he had to basically admit that he was wrong, was in a case where he said Hakir na. Hakir Biser, he told his father about Yosef with the word Hakir, because it says Hakir na, Akton bin Chahi, Imlo. Is this your son's cloak or not? So he said, Hakir na. Yaakov, can you identify it? Hakir Bisru, the Mida Keneged Mida, that he was punished, and then he has to admit he's wrong and be embarrassed. That is Bisru Bakrinal Lami. When Tamar says, why don't you recognize or identify who these items belong to? Na. Why does it say, I care not, please? Eina Lashon Bakasha. She's basically begging him to declare who these belong to. Amra Lei Bakasha Mimcha. Haker Pnei Borecha. Recognize the Kodesh Baruch Hu. Val Talim Enecha Mimeni. And do not turn your eyes away from me. Don't ignore my fate. Don't lie. If you don't come forward now, I'm going to die. And she was pregnant at the time. And so will the fetuses inside of me. Vayakir Yehuda, Vayomer Tzadka Mimeni. So Yehuda recognizes them, acknowledges that they belong to him. Says she was more righteous than I. Haynu Damar, Rav Chanan Bar Bizna, Rav Shimon Chasida, Yosef Shekidei Shem Shemayim Deseit, there. Yosef, who was Mekadesh Shem Shemayim in private, in the story with Eshet Potifar, Zechav Osiv Elo Otachat Nishmo Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Therefore, they added an additional letter to his name, the reward for that which he had done. Tichtev, Edut B'Yosef Samo. It's Thursday today. We said it in today's Shosh Hayom. Edut B'Yosef. There it's spelled with a hey in there. And therefore, now the name has Yud Kei in it. And so now it resembles the Shem Hashem. And the truth is, it's Yehosef. It has Yud Kei Vav. And it's just missing the last hey. But that's through that extra letter that was added there. Yehuda. Shekidei Shem Shemayim Refesia. Yehuda was a Kiddush Hashem in public when he admitted that Tamar was right, said Kami Meni. Zachav and Yikra Kulo Shmo Shem HaKadosh Baruch Hu. His name is permanently the name like Hashem, which is Yehuda. Now, it's interesting because the Gemara uses that as an example of someone who by mistake is trying to write the Shem Hashem, he writes Yehuda. So first of all, there's a huge similarity or confusion that can come up between the two words because the Shem Hashem is Yud Kei Vav Kei and Yehuda is Yud Kei Vav. And then there's a K at the end, but a dalet in between. So there's one extra letter. So they're very similar. Again, the Gemara uses that to describe a mistake made by the Sofer in Mekadesh, the shame that he says, writes Yehuda instead because of that closeness or similarity. The issue here is that Yehuda's name was there all along. He always had the name Yehuda. So then what's unique about this incident that makes him get the name? So you could say that this incident makes him deserving of the name or generally, when parents give name to a children, we see that being born out of some sort of Ruach HaKodesh. And his mother, when she called him Yehuda, was looking to the future, seeing that that was going to be the trait or the character of Yehuda. The other possibility is that that's exactly the Midah Keneged Midah, which is that Yehuda, who did Mizkadesh Shem Shemayim for Hesya, his name is by definition the Shem Hashem, and always was the Shem Hashem. But Yosef, who was Mekadesh Shem Shemayim B'tzina'ah, there you have to add on a letter to his name. It's not the natural thing, because we have to expose that which was hidden. It wasn't obvious that Yosef was Mekadesh Shem Shemayim. So therefore, in order to indicate that, they added a letter to his name to show us and to tell us that. Yehuda did it before Esya. We don't need any news reel to tell us that that happened. And therefore, his name itself is the Shem Hashem, because we don't need to add anything. We don't need to make any indications that something changed over here. Kevin Shehuda v'amar tzadka mimeni. After Yehuda admits to his guilt here and says that she is more righteous than I, yatzta bat kol v'amra. Then a heavenly voice came out and said, "Atay tzalta Tamar u'shnei b'nei minaor. You saved Tamar and her two children that were going to be born, the twins, from the fire. Chayecha sh'ani matzil b'zchutka gimu b'nei minaor. Mida k'neged mida. You saved three people from the fire. I'm going to save three of your descendants from the fire." Referring to Maninu, Hananya, Mishael, Vazariah, three individuals who Nebuchadnezzar throws into the fire and who are not consumed by the fire. Tzadka mimeni, she is more righteous than I. Mina Yoda, how did he know? This is an interesting problem. So even though Yehuda acknowledges that he had biyah with her and acknowledges that she's not necessarily culpable over here, nevertheless, how is he certain about that? Because it's true that he might admit that he slept with her. Doesn't mean that no other man slept with her. If she's already, quote-unquote, a zonah, maybe she slept with other men. And how does he know that the children that are born here are really his children? Or how does he know that she's more righteous than I because she was pregnant from him and no one else? So yatzta bat kol v'amra. That's because a heavenly voice came out and confirmed or affirmed her innocence here. V'amra mimeni yatzu kibushim. That this came out from me. This was all my plan and my plot, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says. Rashi says, Divrei Kivushim means something that's hidden, or hidden words, that this was Hashem's plan in order to have Malchut Beit David and Mashiach come from Tamar and Yehuda. So this was my plan for it to happen this way. And so basically Hashem gives acknowledgement to the behavior of Tamar, her stamp of approval here, through that bat kol. And that's what gives Yehuda the confidence that Tamar is innocent, that did this l'shem shamayim, and that he was the only one that had biyah with her, and these were his children. Others suggest over here the word kvushim comes from the word kavush, means to pickle, and to put them together, or join them together. V'amrami meni yatsu kvushim. And the girsa is not mimeni, but mimcha. That Hashem declares, mimchaim kvushim. That these pickled children are coming out from you, meaning these twins are your twins. So here you have the bat kol affirming that these are the children of Yehuda. Or still others read the word kvushim, those that will conquer. And that means that these individuals, these twins that come out, will be the future conquerors of Eretz Yisrael, which again is an affirmation that these are the children of Yehuda. So that's why Yehuda was certain over here, is because a bat kol, a heavenly voice, came out to affirm that they were his children. After he knew her in the sense of intercourse, he didn't stop knowing her. I mean, that once he realized that she was justified, or that her behavior was correct, and she did l'shem shamayim, plus she gets an affirmation from Kadosh Baruch Hu, then Yehuda felt comfortable remaining with her, keeping her on as a wife. Whereas Rashi over here translates yada not as bi'ah, the way that we would normally translate it, but shehid sadkat, l'shem shamayim nitkadvah. That yediyah here is literally a yediyah. Once he knew that she had done it l'shem shamayim, then he remained with her, stayed married to her. If you can translate yediyah as being yediyah, like is used in the Torah to mean between a husband and wife, and that once he had biyah with her the first time after this incident, he stayed together with her. Or yediyah, according to Rashi, is literally that he understood now that she had acted l'shem shamayim, and therefore he remained with her, stayed with her. And how does he know here that the word lo yasaf means that he did not stop? That by the Matan Torah, it says that there was a loud noise or a shofar blowing, and it didn't stop. Lo pasak, it didn't end. So that's an interesting issue with the verse with lo yasaf in the Torah. Chazal, when it shows up in the Torah, especially noted by Eldad Medad, when they have their nevuah in the middle of the Am, and it says there, v'lo yasaf, question of lo yasaf can have one of two interpretations. Lo yasaf means that you do not do more, or do not continue, or lo yasaf can mean lo pasak, they did not stop. And so the question, whenever you have this, like in our instance over here, what does it mean, v'lo yasaf, o the data? Does that mean lo pasak, he did not stop being together with her? Or lo yasaf means that he did not continue to be together with her? And we see a machloket in the drash by Chazal in these words when they show up in the Torah as to whether they mean that they consistently continue to do this, or lo yasaf means they did not continue to do it. And over here, we see the drasha on the side of lo pasak mimena, that he did not desist from being together with her. Avshalom nitga besaro, so as we said earlier in the Gemara says we'll come back and discuss Avshalom and his hair. How do we know that he was nitga besaro? Tan Rabbanan. Avshalom b'saro marad, that he rebelled with his hair, shenemar, uchav shalom laya ish yafeh, there was no more beautiful than Avshalom, ubigalcho et rosho, and when he used to shave his head, v'yam iketz yamim liyamim, he did this on a regular interval. We saw this in the Gemara in Nazir, the darshan that is from year to year, or the other dayot, that he did it on a more regular interval, asher yigaleach ki kaved alav, he used to cut off the hair because it became heavy for him. Vikucho, he would shave it. Shakal etzarosho matayim shkalim be'eben hamelech. And then he used to weigh the hair to see how much it weighed. So that's what most people note over here, that if he was a Nazir, like the Gemara suggests, then there was nothing wrong with him cutting off his hair and doing this. The problem was that he became obsessed with his hair, and he would weigh his hair, and he would make a big deal out of his hair. So that was the problem over here. Tano, what is this Eben HaMelech? That is the Evan Anshet Verbi Anshet Tzipori Shoklim Ba. That is the stone weight that is used by Tzipori and Tveria as their weights. And that's what they say that is meant by Evan HaMelech here. The Fikach Nitla Besaro. And therefore in the end, he was caught by his hair. So first of all, it's a part of his beauty is his hair. And we know hair plays a central role in terms of beauty, and especially with regards to the Nazir, the central role that hair plays with regards to the Nazir. So here it's supposed to be something that is L'shem Shamayim, something that's positive. Meantime, Avshalom is using it in a haughty, self-centered manner that focused on his beauty. And his beauty was part of what attracted the people to come and rebel with him. So he uses his beauty and his sweet-talking to bring them in. So therefore, in the end, he's punished by that. And how do we know that? Shenemar, because the Pasuk says, Vayikarei Avshalom lifnei avdei David v'Avshalom. It happened to be that Avshalom chanced in front of the Avadim of David, v'Avshalom rochev al ha-pered, and he was riding on the mule, v'yavo ha-pered tachat shoveh chayla gdola. The mule ran under the thick branches of the elm, and here we have v'yochez, but it actually says in the Pasuk is v'yachazak rosho v'ayla, that his head got caught on the tree. And obviously when they use v'yochez is that they're translating, what does it mean, v'yachazak? Means vayochez, he got caught or tangled in his hair. Vayiutan ben shamayim ben aretz, and then he was suspended between heaven and earth. Vahapered asher tachtav avar, and the mule keeps going, and he's left hanging by the tree. Shakal safsira balamifseke. So an easy way to solve the problem: if he's caught by his hair, he'd just take out his sword or his knife, cut his hair, and that would release him. Why didn't he do that? We know that right afterwards, Avshalom and his weapons bearers catch Avshalom because of this, and they kill him. So Tanit be Rabbi Shmuel b'oto sha'a nifke'u sh'o mitachtav. At that moment, the Gehinom opened up under him. So now the Gemara is explaining, why was he fearful to cut his hair? Because if he cut his hair, then he would fall into Gehinom. Now whether you take that literally, that Gehinom opened under him, so therefore he's reluctant or reticent to cut his hair, because then he's going to fall into Gehinom. But whether you take that figuratively, which is that he knew that he had done wrong, and that he needed a kapara. If he cuts his hair and escapes now, then he won't gain that kapara. If he remains there, trapped, and then is killed, that will act as a kapara for the terrible acts that he had perpetrated. For Gaza Melech. So when David gets wind of the fact that they killed Avshalom, remember that when David gives instructions to his people when they go to battle with Avshalom, they said that you're allowed to kill anyone, but you got to bring me Avshalom alive. I don't want you to kill him. Yoav takes matters into his own hands, ignores what the king says, and kills Avshalom. So then when the king gets word of this, Vayigaza Melech, Vayala al Aliyata Shar, the king was upset, disturbed by the fact that Avshalom had been killed. So he went up to the upper chamber, Vayif, and he cried. And as he's walking and going, he says, Bini Avshalom, Bini, Bini Avshalom. So here it's going to be important to count how many times the word Bini appears, which is going to be the number 8. So it says, my son Avshalom, my son Avshalom, mi temuti ani tachtecha. I would give up my life so that you don't have to die instead of you and replace you, Avshalom. Bini, Bini. So we're up to 5 times already. Then a little skip down, we move to the next pasuk. Vamelech la'at et panav. He wrapped up his face or his head. Vayizak ha'melech kol gadol, and he cries out in a great cry and voice. Bini Avshalom, my son Avshalom, Avshalom, Bini, Bini. So here we're up to 8 times the word ben is now mentioned in these 2 psukim. Hanitamnaya bini loma. Why does David mention the word bini 8 times? Shiva da'aske mishiva madure gehinom. 7 of them to take Avshalom out of the 7 depths of Gehinom. Beidach, and the last one, Ikadamri, the Kariv Reisha, the Gabe Gufei. Last one, so that he brought his head back together with his body. Which is interesting, because we don't see anywhere where his head was separated from his body. Ikadamri, the Aiti La Umadati. Or the last other opinion is that that brought him up to Olam Abba, that final Bini. Now, Tosfot over here tries to reconcile between the Agadata here and the Agadata in Achilek. The one thing that he does note is that we have a principle in Perek Achilek that bra mizakeyav, that a child can be a zchut for the parent, and that's why after the passing of a parent, the child does a Kiddush Hashem and tries to do things that are mekadesh Shem Shemayim, like saying Kaddish, like davening for the Amud, to give a zchut to their parent. But the other way is not true. But a Av is not Mizake Bra, but the father is not Mizake this child. But yet here, David HaMelech is being Mizake his child. So Tosu gives a number of answers, all of which are interesting. It says, V'yesh Lamar, Shum Dav Shalom Natalet Shalom Bo'olam Hazeh. Shnerag b'mita mishuna, huilo lo tfilat aviv. So Avshalom over here took care of his own problem, which is that because he was killed in such an unusual manner, with it hanging by his hair, and then having the weapons bearers and Avshalom and kill him with the darts and the daggers and the spears, all of that was a mita mishuna, which basically was a kapara for Avshalom. And that's why David's tefillah was able to help him, because he had a somewhat of a schut or kapara on his own. Va'od, Avshalom lo avad avodat kochavim. Avshalom never worshipped avodah zarah, which is a grievous sin, and maybe there, that's where the father can't help out the son. Inami matzi the meimer, hadamar abalom zaki broad, that which we say a father cannot bring schut to the child. Hadamishim kvod ha'av, emonim limnoto emishreim below tefillah. Because the kvod ha'av, we won't necessarily not mention this child as being a rasha in order to protect the honor of the father. But with tefillah, then we would grant the father that request. So bra, that the father's name is Zakah the bra, is the standard or is the default state. And that's why the Gemara over there says that Abraham can't save Ishmael and Yitzchak can't save Esav. But nevertheless, David was able to save Avshalom because of what Tosfot here claims are a number of possibilities. Either because Avshalom died such an unusual death that he already taken care of himself, which is no longer deemed to be a rasha, or that's only with regards to avodah zarah that we say that the father doesn't have the ability to save the child, or with regards to other avirot he does, or do we say that the idea that the father is not zochet to protect the child means that the child will be known or deemed or spoken about as a rasha and not protected because of the honor of the father? But that doesn't mean that the father can't help the child out if he davens for him, and therefore davening will help even from a father to a child. Now the Gemara continues with this agarat about Avshalom. Avshalom lakach, yetzev lo b'chayav. So he went ahead and he took, and he put up a monument during his lifetime. My lakach. What does it mean that he took? Because the word lakach in general means to purchase or to acquire. What is he purchasing, acquiring over here when he put up this monument during his lifetime? Rish Lakish lakach mechach ra le'atzmo. He either took bad advice or he chose a bad path for himself. Et matzevet asher be'emek ha'melech, he put up this monument in the valley of the king. And that's why today, actually, there's a monument down in the Kidron Valley that is known as Yad Avshalom. It's not really what Avshalom built, but we know that Avshalom built a monument to himself in a deep valley that is adjacent to Ir David, because it's in the Emek HaMelech, and therefore the people assumed, or they made up, that that was Yad Avshalom. Amar Rabbi Chanina Rabbi Papa, Be'etza Amuka Shel Malko Shel Olam. So what does that mean in Emek HaMelech? That means that by the deep-seated plans of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, this all happened. Dichtiv, because it says, Hinei Mekim Alecha Ra'ami Beitecha. This is the punishment that David is told by Natan HaNavi for his sleeping with Bathsheba, that there's going to be bad or things that come up within your household. And therefore, Avshalom is the fulfillment of that promise from HaKadosh Baruch Hu that there will be those from amongst your family that will rise up and rebel against you. And so Avshalom is the fulfilling of that promise of punishment that Natan HaNavi had suggested to David. And again, Avshalom didn't have to be the one. The fact that Avshalom did it is of his own free choice. But it was a kiyum of that promise that this evil or this bad would happen. So the Gemara sees that this monument over here is not that he acquired a monument, but rather he made bad choices or he got bad advice that he wanted to make himself into a monument, into a leader, into the kingship, or also play on B'emek HaMelech. It was something that HaKadosh Baruch Hu had planned, or this was the fulfillment of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's plan. And the Gemara says, Kiyosef et Devarat HaOmer, similar to what happens by Yaakov when he sends Yosef to see his brothers, it says, Vayeshalchem me'er Chevron, that he sent him out from the valley of Chevron. Well, Chevron's not in the valley. We know that Chevron is at the tail end of Harei Yehuda. It's up in the mountains. So where does it mean, me'er Chevron? And Rav Chanina bar Papa, Eitza Amuka, Shaloto Tzadik, Shekavur be'Chevron. Because of that deep plan, deep-seated plan from the one who's buried in Chevron, which is Avraham Avinu, Dechtiv, Yadoa Teida, Kigeriye Zaracha. That's what it's meant in the Brit Ben Abtarim, that says you should know that your offspring will be strangers in a foreign land. So here, this fulfillment, the fulfillment of Bnei Israel going down to Mitzrayim to fulfill Brit Ben Abtarim starts with this incident of Yaakov sending Yosef to see his brothers. And that's what it means, Me'emek Chevron, not literally from the valley of Chevron, but rather from that deep-seated plan that was in Hebron, which is that Bnei Yisrael need to end up in Mitzrayim, to Mimikayim Brit Ben Abtarim, and that's Yaakov, unbeknownst himself, is sending out Yosef to generate the fulfillment of that promise. And similarly over here, Absalom, who is rebelling, but unbeknownst to him, is rebelling to fulfill the punishment that HaKadosh Baruch Hu had promised to David. Now, it keeps darshing that pasuk over there. Why does he build this monument? Ki amar ein li ben. I don't have any children. B'lo avalei b'nei. What do you mean? He didn't have children? Raktiv. V'yavaldu l'Avshalom shlosha banim u'bat achat. That Avshalom has three sons and one daughter, the daughter who he names after his sister Tamar. Amar av Yitzhak bar Avdimish lo yalo ben hagun l'malchut. He had children, but he didn't see any of those children as his successors, or individuals who would then have the possibility of taking the kingship, and therefore he put up a monument to himself. Rav Chisda Amar Gemiri, that we have a Mesorah, and Avshalom was aware of this Mesorah, that anybody who burns the fields of his friend does not leave behind an inheritor. And we know that Avshalom burnt the fields of Yoav, Dichtiv, Vayomer Lavadav. Shalom says to his servants, Re'u Chalkat Yoav El Yadi, you see the fields of Yoav which are adjacent to me, below Sham Se'urim, and he has barley that's planted there, the Chuvit Tzitu Abesh, go and set them on fire. V'yatzitu Avdei Avshalom et Chalkat Abesh. And they go over there and they light the whole property of Yoav in fire. Avshalom was doing this because Yoav had helped Avshalom come back from exile after he had killed Amnon. He came back, but he wasn't able to have an audience with the king. And basically, he was in exile, but in exile in his own home or in his own place in Yerushalayim. So he was no longer with his grandfather, Tamai, the king of Geshur. But now he's back in Yer David, but stuck in Galut. So in order to precipitate Yoav helping him to get back to the king, he sets Yoav's fields on fire to get Yoav's attention and make Yoav realize that he's got to help out Avshalom, much to the detriment of David HaMelech and Klal Yisrael, that Yoav brought Avshalom back and then helps him to get an audience with the king, because it only led to bad things in the end. But Avshalom realized that because of that Mesorah, that his children would not survive, and therefore he wanted to put up a monument to himself. You could also suggest that putting up a monument is a sign of Gava, also a practice of someone who is the king. And this was indicative of Avshalom's aspirations to become the king of Israel and replace his father David. And this is really a premonition or precursor to his rebellion that he's going to lead against David to try to usurp the power of the king. And that's what the Matzeva is here, and that's what's being described here, that everything he's doing is all a part of his rebellion. Maybe even the fact that he saw that his children were not worthy of being kings, that he realized, well, if it's not me, it's not going to be my offspring, my descendants, therefore I got to be the one who takes the opportunity now to become the king, and that's why he rebels. So the Gemara here connects between the behaviors of Avshalom and his rebellion, and his putting up of the monument to himself, that he should be remembered. Okay, we're going to stop here by the two dots on the top of Yud Aleph, Amud Aleph.